It's Texas Standard Time on this February 3rd. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Feels like it's been quite a long time since Inauguration Day, doesn't it? When historians look back on this period in time, there will no doubt be many footnotes about Twitter diplomacy in a new brusque and blusterous language of international political communication. But something tells me that the focus on personality more than the presidency right now just might hide a stunning turn, a new cycle in modern history. Look, we already know that the Pax Americana, the positioning of America as a multinational leader pushing Western-style liberal democracy as a way to maintain global order, is changing for a variety of reasons. But what do we call this shift? Well, here's one modest proposal. What we may be looking at is a shift from transnationalism to transactionalism. In its crudest sense, what we're seeing is Mr. Trump's art of the deal applied to global politics, with a result, a predictable undermining of the language of multilateral diplomacy with a preference for independent agreements struck between nations, a new global bilateralism, if that's not an oxymoron. Hard to say, since political discourse hasn't previously required an MBA, but it's hard to deny that what we are in the middle of, for better or worse, is a rapid development in real time of a new political order without the intellectual underpinnings that preceded the previous post-war prescription for world peace. And since that discussion hasn't been had, it's hard to imagine how this won't cause chaos as capitals, including ours, try to figure out how to navigate what very much appears to be the next realignment. But compare and contrast the chaos on the domestic front, still very much mired in political maps, mistrusts, mythologies we've developed over the last 70 years. These include some rather familiar fault lines: free speech versus hate speech, separation of church and state versus religious liberty. Case in point, a pledge renewed yesterday at a prayer breakfast in Washington, to quote the New York Times. When President Trump told an audience of religious leaders on Thursday that he would destroy the Johnson Amendment, he declared his intention to sign a bill that would fundamentally alter a major aspect of the church-state divide that has been a constant in American politics for generations. Close quote. Under the Johnson Act, named for the then-senior senator from Texas who sponsored the measure, tax-exempt entities like churches and charitable organizations may not directly or indirectly participate in any political campaign on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate. And that means ministers may not use the pulpit to endorse or oppose candidates. If they do, the churches risk losing tax-exempt status. When it was passed, it wasn't very controversial, approved by a Republican Congress, signed by Eisenhower, a Republican president. But the backstory here is a whole lot more complicated than meets the eye. And in a sense, it's Texas politics writ large. William Martin is a senior fellow of religion and public policy at Rice University's Baker Institute. Professor, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David.
Let's go back to 54, when this was first introduced by Lyndon B. Johnson. How did this Johnson Amendment come about?
Well, he wanted to dampen the effects of not religious organizations, actually charities or political organizations that were going to lobby against him or run political ads. He wanted to take away the tax-deductible status of any of those organizations. And that included religious organizations, but that really wasn't what was on his mind.
What was on his mind?
Well, he wanted the people who were, for example, who were supporters of McCarthy, not to be able to take him on and act as if he were weak against communism.
So he was trying to go after his own political opponent. This is politics.
Precisely, yes.
So how did it become to be a centerpiece of the church-state divide as it is presented today?
Well, religious contributions have been deductible since, I think, around 1917, been clarified since then. But it's a major advantage for churches to be able to raise more money, as for charitable organizations, as for universities and other organizations, that not to take a partisan political stance.
Well, you know, the Johnson Amendment, though, preceded an explosion in non-for-profit tax-exempt groups that ProPublica found out do engage in political efforts. They buy ads in favor of their favorite political candidates, but they claim to have a social welfare purpose, though that being the key sort of wording there. Doesn't this suggest an unfair burden on churches if they can't do the same?
Well, churches can speak on issues. They can freely campaign for issues. And it's often clear that which party they are in favor of. And they can do many other things. They can conduct nonpartisan voter drives. Pastors, indeed, played a key role in the rise of the religious right. And if they stipulate they're not acting in the name of the church, then they can do whatever they like. And of course, particularly in the Christian conservative movement among evangelicals, since 2008, they have exercised what they call Pulpit Freedom Day and preach really partisan sermons, and many of them have sent sermons to the IRS daring them to act. The churches that he's speaking to and catering to have hardly been muzzled, but almost everywhere in the world where people are at war, religion has played a role, and usually a negative one, and in this country, religion contributes to a growing and disturbing polarization, and taking down this already weak barrier would not help.
Well, let me ask you about something, because this resonates in the minds of a lot of Texans. Back in 2014, as you, I'm sure, recall, the city of Houston issued subpoenas demanding that pastors turn over sermons dealing with homosexuality, gender identity, or Anise Parker, who was the city's first openly lesbian mayor. And they were told that if they didn't comply, they could be held in contempt of court. Well, of course, that blew up politically on the local front. But for the churches, the issue for them was whether or not these subpoenaed documents could call their tax-exempt status into question. Is that what we want?
I don't think we want that. And the ministers have a right to speak on behalf of issues. They should not have spoken and said, you should support Anise Parker or you should oppose Anise Parker. But they have the right to speak on issues.
But doesn't that underscore what a lot of religious figures who want to see this removed, doesn't that underscore their fears? Use of the Johnson Amendment as a kind of political tactic of intimidation.
I'm not sure that what's the intimidation here? They want to have more freedom, but I think the Johnson Amendment and indeed the Constitution, you go back to Jefferson. Jefferson said religious establishment bribes and runs the risk of corrupting religion when it offers rewards from the public coffers, in this case, tax exemption. Madison was talking about that too. In this case, richer churches and denominations, larger ones, would have a government-financed political advantage. And that's what I think we really need to avoid.
William Martin is a senior fellow of religion and public policy at Rice University's Baker Institute. Dr. Martin, thanks so much for speaking with the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. It's always a pleasure.